January 31st, 2005, as a subcommittee until we get a quorum. I'd like to open up the public hearing on SCR 1, which recognizes February 4th, 2005 is Go Red for Women's Day, and I'd like to have Rick Berkobian do a summary, please.
Thank you, Chair. Probably our esteemed presenters could do a much better job than I, but I'll just briefly note that this is a American Heart Association sponsored Go Red for Women's Day, which is a multi-year campaign to raise awareness about cardiovascular disease among women, and it is one of the leading causes of death in Oregon. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. I think you'll all see that many of us are wearing red today, and as a women's movement, wearing red is a personal declaration about making smart choices to reduce our risks for heart disease. Heart disease is preventable if you eat the right foods and if you exercise. And we have some esteemed people to start testifying. I would like to have Senator Winters, Senator Kate Brown, and Governor Barbara Roberts, please come forward.
When you open this poll.
Okay. We have a quorum. I open the full committee of this Health Policy Committee.
Okay.
Senator Brown, do you want to start?
Thank you. For the record, Senator Kate Brown, I'm going to turn it over to Senator Winters, and then I'll go, and then we'll go to our esteemed friend who's here today.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm Senator Jackie Winters, and I'm thank you for hearing us this afternoon, and members of the Senate committee. You know, it's kind of nice to see us all in red, because it does symbolize a very, very important issue. And I want to personally thank Governor Barbara Roberts and the American Heart Association for launching a campaign asking women to take responsibility for the health of their lives. Through awareness, women can take personal steps towards a life free of cardiovascular disease and strokes. As a member of the Human Services Subcommittee, I am proud of the efforts our state is making for a healthy future. From tobacco cessation to prescription drug benefits, we are investing in programs that make a difference. By encouraging physical activity with good public policy, our children can be more fit and healthy. The appearance of adult onset diabetes in young children is unacceptable. And as you know, Madam Chair, there is a correlation between all of these. I want to thank you, the Senate Health Policy Committee, for bringing this resolution forward in a timely manner. And I would like to also say, had this kind of awareness occurred during the time when my mother was alive, that perhaps she would have had a much longer life. I think we've learned a lot more about how to keep our bodies healthy and how nutrition and exercise play a valuable part in our own longevity.
Thank you, Senator Winters. I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 21. I'm honored to be here with many of Oregon's leading women to draw attention to a disease that kills thousands of women every year. Cardiovascular disease affects almost 1 in 10 Oregonians and claims the lives of over 500,000 women per year nationwide. Women face 6 major risk factors for heart disease, all of which can be prevented, controlled, or treated with diet, exercise, and sometimes prescribed medications. I will note for the record that I did not see any of you at the YMCA this morning at 6 a.m. I look forward to seeing you future mornings, whether it's in the pool or in the gymnasium. The risk factors include high blood pressure, high cholesterol, tobacco smoke, physical inactivity, obesity, and diabetes. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, especially those male colleagues who are wearing red, I thank you for your commitment to improving the health of women in Oregon, and I encourage you to pass Senate Concurrent Resolution 1. And I am also pleased to welcome Governor Barbara Roberts, a champion and role model for women across the state, and also my constituent.
Thank you very much. I'm Barbara Roberts. I'm here from Southeast Portland. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm delighted to have a chance, an opportunity really, to testify today on the important issue of women's health. I also want to thank Senator Pete Brown and Senator Jackie Winters for co-sponsoring Senate Concurrent Resolution 1. February is American Health Heart Month, and during February, I'm calling on all women, especially young women, to take charge of their health and fight heart disease before it's too late. And I know what too late feels like. I lost both my mother and my only sister to heart disease. According to the American Heart Association, cardiovascular disease, including heart disease and stroke, is the most dangerous threat to a woman's life. Cardiovascular disease claims 10 times more lives than breast cancer in Oregon. About 5,000 women per year in our state. 5,000 Oregon mothers, daughters, sisters, and wives. No other killer of women takes more lives, disables more females, and ruins more careers, leaving its surviving victims to live with the debilitating effects of heart disease and stroke. And yet, the American Heart Association found that less than 20% consider cardiovascular disease their greatest health risk. We must change that awareness. It's time for women to start taking care of ourselves and to, as the American Heart Association says, go red. Now, what does it mean to go red? Well, first of all, it means making our own health a priority. It means changing women's awareness of the dangers of heart disease and stroke. And it means the passage of Senate Concurrent Resolution 1. SCR 1 designates February 4, 2005 as Go Red for Women Day. It encourages women to wear a red dress or a red hat or slacks or a sweater. It is a way to bring attention to the startling truth about women and heart disease. And we encourage men to show support for the women in their lives with a red tie or a red shirt or both. February 4th will be the kickoff, really just the kickoff for a year-long campaign to raise the awareness of the impact of heart disease and stroke on women's health. Going red also means looking at your own personal risk factors for heart disease and stroke. High blood pressure, high cholesterol, lack of exercise, being overweight. It means seeing a doctor to understand and control those risk factors. In addition to the passage of SCR 1, as state leaders, we are also asking you to become aware of other legislation that will speak to the serious health threat to Oregonians, women, men, and our children. The American Heart Association asks all of us to understand that tobacco and obesity are the two most preventable causes of cardiovascular disease. Increased physical activity is a key component in the fight against obesity. So that's why you have to go to the Y.
Or other health
I personally want to thank President of the Senate, Peter Courtney, and Bill Morissette, Senator Morissette, for their strong efforts during the legislative interim that resulted in legislative bills to establish physical education minimum minutes for grades K through 8. As a member of the Oregon Health Policy Commission, I have worked to include this important policy in the Commission's recommendations to this legislature. Senate Bill 228 encompasses this crucial policy, and I look forward to working with you toward passage of this legislation to keep our children healthy and to keep them active. Good health begins very early. In addition to obesity, one cannot speak about heart disease or stroke without facing the number one preventable cause of heart disease and stroke, tobacco use. My mother and my sister were both smokers. We must use every opportunity to educate our citizens about the harmful effects of smoking. In addition to death and disability, the financial cost of heart disease and stroke in this country is over $350 billion annually. The American Heart Association and the Oregon Health Policy Commission are supporting policy reforms that will limit the public's exposure to the dangers of secondhand smoke. And also, we want to ensure that Oregon's successful tobacco education program is able to continue its comprehensive approach to reduce the number of Oregonians that smoke. Now, there's much we can do to reduce the burden of cardiovascular disease for Oregonians. Let's start by making a bold statement with SCR 1, designating February 4th as Wear Red Day and calling attention to the number one killer of women in our state and nationally. Let's show Oregon women that we care about their heart health by encouraging them to go red in 2005 and, more importantly, to go red for life. I appreciate your time and your attention and your courtesy today. I appreciate being here with these two fine senators, and I urge your support of Senate Concurrent Resolution 1.
Thank you so very much. Is there any discussion, comments? Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Brown, I didn't see you at 24-hour fitness, so we're even. I want to thank you folks for bringing this to us. I wish my wife was listening. She's somebody I need to educate, and I feel a little bit concerned that every time smoking is mentioned, everybody looks at me. But be that as it may, and I also want to thank the American Heart Association. Our work with them over the past few years has got us some very good results. The automatic external defibrillators that we required in public buildings, and just what, 4 days ago, there was a man in Eugene who collapsed. He was close to a machine. They saved his life. You know, so it's an ongoing effort to not only get us healthier, but keep us alive. So very supportive.
Madam Chair, can I respond?
Yes.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. I just wanted to mention my father's had several open heart surgeries and continues to smoke to this day. But I will say that he was playing tennis at a tennis court and had a cardiac arrest, and there was a defibrillator on the court, and my father is alive today because of that defibrillator. We had this conversation with the Senate President this morning asking where the defibrillators were in the building. So I think that would be another project to make sure that everyone in the building knows where they are and how they operate.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for being here. I was at the YWCA this morning. That's where you'd be.
Good for you, Senator Morissette.
Okay. I think that what we need to do with the bill that requests a certain number of minutes in physical education that you referred to, we need to make it into a positive kind of program by giving awards, as the presidential fitness program did years ago. Because I don't know how. First of all, I don't know if that's an unfunded mandate that will die along the way. But I don't think we should let it die. I think the idea is very important, and we should persuade the governor maybe to recognize students. We should persuade the representative of the Heart Association to dress in a great big heart suit and go around and give awards to kids who... Red, yes, red. No, seriously, though, I think it is an important program, and I think we have to approach it from two different tacks. We could ask the schools, we could require that they do it, but we could also make it into a positive recognition program. And I think people would then do it for that reason as well. So it is a good idea, and we should figure out how to make it happen.
If I might, thank you, Senator. I turned 68 last month, and it makes you sort of aware of your vulnerability a little bit in terms of your health. But I also come from a generation of women who didn't, for the most part, exercise. It was not ladylike. We didn't do it. It's what boys did. And so I grew up not exercising. It's very hard to start that pattern late in your life if you haven't had that pattern throughout your life. And so one of the advantages of this piece of legislation Senator Morissette is talking about is that it gets kids in the habit of exercising, of thinking of their physical health, of, feeling good about their health. And I just think it is much harder to start that same process at some later point in life. You have bad eating habits, you have bad exercise habits, all of which I've had. And I think that's one of the advantages of it, is not just that they're getting the exercise now, but that they're forming lifelong patterns. And for women, I think particularly mature women, that's been a very hard change for us. And we've worked hard to see ourselves in that way. And that's one of the reasons we're encouraging young women to start early on this issue, because they're so vulnerable, and if they build that pattern of exercise and good health, it will stick with them for life.
Senator Marcet, I'm just probably in the same generation as Governor Roberts.
You notice she didn't give you her age. I'm just so grateful she's alive.
And having said that, I can remember PE. I can remember when it was a requirement in as part of the school curriculum, and I can also remember that, you know, you may not have liked to have done all of those setups and all the things that we had to do, but at least it reminded you that you had to deal with fitness, and so I think it's important. It really is important when we talk about life's experiences, because we do learn our habits, and we do learn a lot of them from our educational community as well as our home community. And children, we tend to spend more time in our educational community, quite frankly, than we do in the home environment. And so I would just encourage that we continue to talk about that we really do need to have a physical fitness within our schools. And also, and looking at nutrition, some of us have spent some time getting rid of those extra pounds that we put on in when we're sitting in all these committees, and I think all of us have gone through saying we need to walk more, we need to change our dietary habits, and even if we don't go to the Y, we do some physical activities in this building. And I just think the more that we can set the tone and the pace in this building, and encourage our educational community, that this is a vital issue. When you look at the stats on obesity among our children, we're getting them ready. And I can recall when my son was born, my youngest son, and a doctor at that time who was very wise, because he ate everything in his pathway. And when I took him for his pediatric fit checkup, he said, "You have to put him on a diet." Because we've learned that that those patterns start very early. And the risk of heart and cardiovascular disease starts taking place early.
Mm-hmm. Senator.
Thank you. Since 1999, I've had a bill that would require physical education in schools. I've had that every year. I didn't introduce that bill this year because we do have something to replace that. So I totally support requiring physical education. I think there's another aspect to young women exercising, and that's osteoporosis, because I doubt if very many young women basketball players will ever get that degenerative bone disease. I think that is...
Except for bad knees, maybe.
Bad knees. But I think, though, that that was a much more common female ailment than it will be in the future because of the athletics and the exercises. So those are two reasons why women need to exercise: osteoporosis and heart. And diet. So there are three reasons.
Thank you. Senator Cruz.
And just
we can go on and on, as you can see.
Well, and we can, but I would feel amiss if I... The one thing that hasn't been mentioned is the growing epidemic of juvenile diabetes in this country, and all of these point to the same direction, and exercise and diet, and we are on the front edge of something that could be incredibly terrible if we don't get on. And it's all about education. It's all about teaching people the right way to live. So it's not only heart disease, it's diabetes, which will hit them before heart disease will. So.
Heart disease is preventable. And I think that one of the things that we haven't mentioned, though, there are some of us who do exercise and try to keep our weight down and eat properly but still get a high blood pressure. And therefore, it's so important to see a physician because there's proper medication that is going to keep your blood pressure down. And I can relate to this very well. And my mother just passed away in November due to complications from a stroke. And she did not go to a doctor, even though her daughter's a nurse, until too late, and the damage was already done from her high blood pressure. So I want to stress that point, too, that you really need to also be under the care of a physician because there are medications that can keep the blood pressure down. All right. Is there any further discussion? I'd like to close the public hearing on SCR1. And I'd like to open a work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution 1.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move SCR1 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Any discussion? Any opposition? Do I need to have the clerk call the roll? The clerk will call the roll. Excuse.
Senator George?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator
Moore?
Aye.
Chair
Monson? Aye. I'd like to... Did you adopt? Yes. SCR1 has been adopted and will be... moved to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. I would like to have Senator Winters and Senator Brown be co-carriers on this bill. Okay. SCR1 is adopted. And the work session for SCR1 is now closed. And the next thing is... Okay. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 225. Is there any further testimony at this point in time on Senate Bill 225? If not, I'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 225, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 225. Do I hear a motion?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 225 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves that Senate Bill 225 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? No further discussion. All those, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Courtney?
Excuse.
Senator George?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator
Morstad?
Aye.
And Chair Monson?
Aye. Motion carries. I would like Senator Cruz to carry this bill.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I close the work session on Senate Bill 225. Open an informational hearing on mental health and addiction disorders at this point in time. And where's the list?
Oh, it's just those two coming up.
David. Okay. So could I have David Pollack and Dr. Jeff Murata please come?
Courtney George coming in to suspend the rules, going to a quick work session.
Wait till they're both here. If they show up.
No. I'm going to restart the whole thing.
Okay. There are some seats up front if any of you want to come and sit. Okay. Do you want to introduce yourself for the record?
Yes,
and
I
I will best laid plans. I had my PowerPoint all set up, but it won't accept my password now that it went to sleep, so I have to start it up again. My name, for the record, is David Pollack. I'm the medical director for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. I'm also a professor of psychiatry and public health and preventive medicine and family medicine at OHSU. And once I get my PowerPoint slides up, I will be glad to talk to you about what I was asked to come speak about today, which has to do with the biological aspects of mental illness and substance use disorders and comments in relation to parity for mental health and addiction disorders that might assist the committee in reviewing related legislation.
You can also work off this if you want.
Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, Jeff,
okay,
while we're waiting.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Murata. I'm the Problem Gambling Services Manager with Department of Human Services. And I'll be following Dr. Pollack's presentation, so I'll let him take the first portion of this presentation.
This is a state computer.
That explains a lot. What are the fortune cookies about?
You know,
open
that
it and find out.
I don't know. We were given little
little things with a pen and two fortune cookies, and I don't know how that relates.
You
to
have
red.
To open the fortune cookie to find out.
That's a little scary.
Are we still? Is it still sleeping? Is that
no? It's coming on right now.
I don't think so.
No, you're fine.
No, you're not. Your camera's up above.
Lights. Reflection camera.
Pretty scenery.
That is lovely.
Yeah.
Pretend it's...
It obviously wasn't from this year.
Where people want to be.
Yes.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, my name is David Pollack. I'm a psychiatrist, and what I'm hoping to talk about are the biological aspects of mental and addictive disorders to begin with, and then I will follow that with some comments on parity issues that really these are sequential topics and I think relate to one another. Many psychiatric disorders, whether mental health conditions or substance use disorders, and if I mistakenly say mental health disorders, I mean both. The various things we generally think about in terms of psychiatric illness as well as substance use disorders in this discussion. Many of them have some kind of biological causes, either because their predisposition that people have because of genetic inherited traits or predisposition to have these illnesses, or because they've acquired them in some way. And I've listed some of the examples of some of the illnesses. Not everyone who has one of these illnesses has a biological cause, but we believe there's a substantial amount of evidence to show that the majority of people who have these illnesses, schizophrenic disorders, major mood disorders, attention deficit disorders, autism, and dementia, not to mention a number of others, have some kind of biological cause. Now, some disorders have biological causes, but the proof is as yet incomplete. Some people believe very strongly that there is enough proof, and others have their doubts about it, but there's a general acceptance that we're on the path to determining that these illnesses have at least some biological etiology or cause. And these include conditions such as obsessive compulsive disorder, panic disorder, certain phobias, and certain personality disorders, such as borderline personality disorder or schizotypal personality disorder, to name a few. Now the water gets a little confusing or muddy, if you will, in that we also know that whether or not they have biological causes, a lot of illnesses have biological consequences. So, in the first bullet there, the brain and other physiological changes, both temporary and long-term, can be associated with a number of different mental health and addiction disorders. And here's some examples. Someone receives some kind of physical injury that leads to brain damage. That leads to an increased risk of behavioral health conditions, such as what we've called in the past organic mental disorders, psychosis, depression, other conditions that actually can be traced to a head injury that the person has received, for example. Trauma of various kinds, whether it's physical or sexual or emotional or neglect, can lead to post-traumatic stress disorder or, in the shorter term, acute stress disorders. And there is a substantial amount of evidence to show that just that stress disorder itself, not physical injury, the stress disorder itself can lead to brain changes that can be lasting, that can affect a child's ability to learn, that can affect a person's ability to concentrate and to sleep, and to include certain kinds of mood disturbances that might result from that. The sustained abuse of addictive substances can lead to lasting brain changes. I'm sure that many of you are familiar with the public service announcements that used to show a fried egg and this is your brain on cocaine or something like that. There's a lot of effective neuroimaging results and other biological testing that's been done to show that the use of alcohol and other substances can have lasting effects on the brain and therefore, in a sense, creates a biologically caused illness. Or manifestations of that. Eating disorders are often misunderstood, but do indeed, and they may have biological causes in and of themselves, but they have biological consequences as well. Young women who have anorexia nervosa, often one of the presenting signs is that they lose the ability to have their regular monthly menstrual periods. They have changes in their hair patterns. They run the risk, whether they have anorexia or bulimia, of having loss of electrolytes and terrible damage to their teeth and gums. These are just a few of many examples. Another confounding issue is that many mental and substance use disorders interact with other illnesses. The main point here is that the mind and the body are inseparable. As much as we like to think of them as separate, they are not. There are a number of psychological consequences of physical illness. For example, the heart disease that was just described in the last presentation. People who have heart disease often become very fearful, concerned about taking risks. People who have diabetes, hypertension, peptic ulcer disease, there's an interaction between their psychological functioning and that physiological illness. There are some psychiatric illnesses that can present or are masked as physical illnesses. These can be as simple as a classic paralysis that used to be called hysteria but is related to some kind of inattention to or inability to deal with a psychological stress. Certain fugue states or dissociative disorders are often mistaken for physiological illnesses. Physical illnesses. Some physical, and I put physical in quotes because a lot of these psychiatric illnesses are physical themselves, but we have the problem of language. So I talk about physical as in the sense of other physical illnesses. But some of these medical surgical illnesses themselves can present with psychiatric symptoms. Thyroid disease, disease that involves the adrenal gland, other illnesses, mitral valve prolapse, can present as anxiety disorders or with mood disorders and can be mistaken as psychiatric illness. So it requires very thorough evaluation and appropriate treatment. The final point here in this slide is that people who have psychiatric illness and substance use disorders are at greater risk of other health problems. People with schizophrenia smoke at a rate of over 90%. People with major psychiatric illness tend to have a greater incidence of heart disease, liver disease, infectious disorders, and other illnesses, so that those illnesses all need to be treated. The impact of disorders is really more important than the cause. And this is the take-home message, I think, of this presentation. In our own experience with the Oregon Health Plan, I was the psychiatrist most involved with the original creation of the prioritized list back in the early 1990s. We learned some very key things. One was that it is more relevant to assess and value conditions in that prioritized list and in what we decide really merits treatment on the basis of the level of severity the amount of suffering that the patient experiences, whether or not the treatment is effective, and what is the impact of not treating that condition, then whether the condition has unambiguous biological causes. And further, even though we would like to identify the causes sometimes, sometimes even in other fields of medicine as well as in psychiatry, we don't know the actual exact biological cause or the molecular cause. Even when we don't, effectiveness and cost-effectiveness of treatment are unrelated to the level of confidence in causation, and those may be more important to focus on than whether or not there's a biological cause.
Question?
So, yes.
Thank you, Senator. Dave, just for example, can you give us an idea of which disorders, mental health disorders, are higher on the list and without the exact numbers of how they kind of...
We did a lot of lumping when we did the list. You know, it was originally about 1,500 items and then whittled down to about 700 items. Of the diagnoses that have psychiatric consequence to them, we condensed the psychiatric diagnosis list from 80 to 100 down to about 50. Of those 50, 42 of them are in the funded portion of the Oregon Health Plan list. Of those 42 that are in that portion are schizophrenic disorders, bipolar disorder, major mood disorder, certain personality disorders, certain adjustment disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder. So a mixture of things that include those that are unambiguously caused or at least have some strong association with biological causes, and some that there is not any clear evidence that there's a biological cause, but were included because the suffering, the burden of illness, and the treatment were important. The treatment was effective, the cost of treatment was manageable, and the cost of not treating was a big problem.
Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on that, how many of those are under the federal mandate?
The
Medicaid.
Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Cruz, I'm not sure whether you mean the federal mandate for Medicaid.
Yes.
Okay. The federal mandate for Medicaid is not specifically related to diagnoses.
Right.
It has to do with people who are disabled or elderly or children in families with dependent children who are below a certain poverty level.
I understand that, but the prioritized list, I mean, there is a whole bunch of health care that's mandated by the federal government. My question was, how much of the mental health block that we have in the prioritized list was in that mandate?
Technically, and someone will have to correct me if I'm wrong, Senator, the federal mandates do not require mental health services. That is an optional service. So technically, none of the mental health conditions would have to be covered through Medicaid. Most states, in fact, I think all states, cover mental health conditions in one way or another.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Welcome, Senator. Moving on to the issue of parity. Mental illnesses are prevalent, and they cause significant suffering. From our epidemiological studies done over the last three decades, we know that a substantial number of people have the risk of mental illnesses, 18 to 20%. And if you include substance use disorders, that increases the number to over 25%, meaning at least one in four people will have one of these illnesses during his or her lifetime. These mental illnesses and substance use disorders carry a high level of disease burden. By that I mean personal and family suffering, lost productivity, not to mention health care costs. Of the top 10 illnesses in the world, measured by the World Health Organization, in terms of disease burden, depression, anxiety disorders, psychotic disorders, and substance use disorders are in the top 10. It's not something to be dismissed. There's an inadequate access to mental health care from specialists and primary care providers, in part because of the lack of adequate coverage. Mental illness is costly. The lack of treatment in the United States costs businesses over $70 billion in lost productivity alone. Some people estimate as high as $130 to $150 billion, but a minimum of $70 billion a year. The use of sick leave and disability and increased use of other health services is often associated with those illnesses not being adequately treated. People with depression have more absentee days and more short-term disability days than people with other kinds of illnesses. Cutting mental health benefits has been shown actually to increase costs to businesses. It's, in a sense, a short-sighted relief that leads to longer-term problems. A lot of people are concerned that psychiatric treatment isn't effective, it's kind of wishy-washy, and that's really a myth that needs to be dispelled. We know a lot more than we used to. The diagnosis and treatment that are used for mental health and chemical dependency disorders are effective. And they are effective for most of these disorders, and they are as good as those treatments for most other conditions. The cutting-edge research that we've seen in the last 10 to 15 years in genetics, neurophysiology, functional imaging, and the interaction between environmental and genetic factors has been dramatically expanding the knowledge of these disorders. So treatment works. We have been identifying evidence-based treatments, and as you know, Senate Bill 267 mandated that we develop in our system in Oregon treatments that are evidence-based in the mental health and addiction field. And we have been developing the methods for doing that. And throughout the country, the same kind of effort has been going on. But to quote the Surgeon General's report on mental health and mental illness issues from 2000, the mental health field is plagued by disparities in the availability of and access to its services. A key disparity often hinges on a person's financial status. Formidable financial barriers block off needed mental health benefits from too many people. And from our own recently released Governor's Mental Health Task Force report, the statement that families who are otherwise insured but are required to cover mental health treatment too often fall into poverty needlessly and at great cost to society, far exceeding the cost of the treatment itself. So how can parity help? This is a complicated set of arguments, and I'm just going to glance over it, and in the discussion or questions I can try to help, or later I can provide written materials that could help. First of all, from the decade from 88 to 97, private sector mental health service expenditures actually dropped by about 50% by eliminating equitable coverage for mental health and chemical dependency conditions. At the same time, other health expenditures had minimal change, may have even gone up in some plans. This arbitrary exclusion of certain categories of illness distorts insurance markets. It shifts the cost to private companies that more reasonably and in some people's view ethically provide that kind of parity, and they get what is called adverse selection because more people then would flock to them, and to the public sector, which is therefore experiencing increased pressures, and it's already overburdened, as we all know. Parity can improve the efficiency of insurance markets by spreading risk more broadly and creating the same floor for mental health coverage as for other forms of medical care. Instead of calling a mandate, I would say that parity is fair. It's fair for patients and it's fair for providers and health plans. The health plan and the provider retain the right and the responsibility to make medical necessity and service limit determinations. That's an important factor. It's not an open door, open the floodgates, and everyone gets whatever they want. At the same time, now if we have parity, patients with mental health and addiction disorders would receive appropriate treatment as they would for any other health care problem that was significant. The concern about costs has often been raised. There's a fear of pent-up demand that people who've been denied care will suddenly flood the doctor's offices. In most places where parity has been introduced and implemented, including our own PEB system, the Public Employee Benefit Board brought in parity 2 years ago, that fear has not been realized. Other states that have had parity legislation have not experienced either the costs or premiums going up much. And in some cases, they've actually gone down. They've realized cost savings. The PEB experience has actually noticed that the premium increase that resulted from that was less than 0.5%. And some people say, well, PEB actually had a pretty good mental health and chemical dependency benefit to begin with. That's true, but at the same time, public employees, the demographic information, epidemiological information will say, as much as we are reluctant to say that because I'm a public employee, have a greater vulnerability and risk of having psychiatric and chemical dependency problems. So there's those two things kind of counterbalance each other. Other studies of parity legislation, both at the federal and state levels, have projected that increases in premium should never probably go higher than 1%. The arguments against parity, otherwise, besides these cost issues, are generally based on misunderstandings. Psychiatric diagnostic system is accurate and it's effective. There are some people that say, as I said earlier, that psychiatric diagnosis is kind of a wishy-washy thing and that these illnesses are not significant. Treatment guidelines are effective. Treatment variations reflect no greater diversity than other medical specialties, and we're doing a lot in Oregon to try to narrow those variations through some of the medication initiatives that we're doing and other approaches that relate to evidence-based practices. The treatment of symptoms, which sometimes is necessary when you don't know the actual cause, is still a valid and a common approach throughout all fields of medicine, not just in terms of psychiatry and substance use treatment. Now, it's sad to say, but most states have parity laws. There are 35 states that have developed them over the last 15 to 20 years. None of them have been repealed, and a number of them have been expanded. In fact, some of the parity bills that have passed in other states started out more narrowly to, quote, biologically based mental illnesses being covered, and then expanded to a much broader range of coverage, as they found it was much less workable to have that segmented coverage. So to conclude, our understanding of mental illness and addiction has never been greater. The illnesses exact a terrible toll on patients and the economy. We have evidence-based treatments that do work. And many providers, consumers, and advocates believe that it's now time for science to triumph over stigma and ignorance and to end what they experience as insurance discrimination. That's the end of my formal comments, and I'd be glad to entertain questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Pollack. Are there questions at this point? Well, you usually don't take them from the audience, but...
I just don't want to interfere with your operation. I've been in hearings where people are interfering, and I don't like
that. Why don't we go with Mr. Mulata?
Let me get his file up. It should be up very shortly.
Should I have him
come up?
Well, while we're waiting, I would like to suspend the rules and open. Do I have a motion to suspend the rules?
We need four.
I just lost one. We can't do it. Never mind. I was trying to be expedient.
I just need a quorum to do that?
We need four. Two-thirds.
To suspend the rules.
There you go.
Okay, you may continue, Dr. Murata.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. What is being handed to you right now is a series of documents, and the slideshow that I'm going to present to you this afternoon is really a condensed version of the information that's being handed out. Just to give you a little bit more background about myself, I've been in the field of problem gambling, really specializing in this field for about 10 years now. I did my doctoral research on recovery from gambling problems. I've worked with a number of problem gamblers as a clinician, and I worked at the Institute for the Study of Gambling and Commercial Gaming, and I've been in my had the privilege to be at my current post for about 4 years now. So this is a subject I'm very passionate about, and I'm also have a lot of gratitude for being asked to come here today and speak with you about this topic that I really am, that I care so deeply about. Well, gambling in Oregon is growing. It's really growing at an astonishing rate. When we look back, just in the past few years, we'll see this latest expansion of gambling. In 2002, Oregonians spent over $1 billion on all forms of gambling. 447 per adult, which is 25% more than the national average, and this is 2002. And in 2003, there was legislation that made way for a 20% increase in the number of video lottery terminals. And the reason that's so significant is because this form of gambling, it appears to be the one that creates the largest number of problem gamblers in society. 2004, the ninth tribal casino opened in Oregon, so now every one of the Confederate tribes of Oregon now operate a casino. And in this current year, it appears inevitable that the lottery is going to expand into electronic slot gaming, and also new tribal casinos are planned to rise closer to Portland. So popularity is really at an all-time high when we talk about gambling. It's portrayed as fun, exciting, glamorous, fashionable, and an easy route to fast money. There's been a recent surge in TV shows. Examples are Celebrity Poker. I think there's a show on Vegas and so forth. There's been gambling merchandise sales have skyrocketed for the first time ever. One of the most popular Christmas gifts has been kind of gambling paraphernalia. It's phenomenal the rate of increase in popularity gambling has experienced as of lately. Well, greater acceptance and increased access creates more gamblers, and we're talking about higher appeal for the old and the very young. And this is my son Tazio, and as you see here, he prefers dollar slots. Well, the more gamblers, the more problem gamblers. The prevalence of gambling disorders in large part is really a function of the overall level of gambling participation. And as I've just reviewed with you, participation is at an all-time high. So what has been Oregon's legislative responses to problem gambling? It's been progressive. It's been perhaps the most progressive out of all the states. Going back in 1991, legislation that authorized video poker included the requirement to fund gambling treatment. And from what I understand is during the debate of whether or not to pass that legislation, one of the requirements was to include funding for treatment. And at that time, 3% of the video lottery proceeds were to go into this gambling treatment fund. There was problems with that bill. The funding was unstable. Then in 1999, legislation was passed that dedicated no less than 1% of lottery proceeds into a gambling treatment fund. And that same bill also moved the administrative responsibility to the Department of Human Services for administering those funds and delivering problem gambling treatment and prevention programs. In 2003, there was actually the elimination of funding for these services. However, that was never executed because of April e-board that restored the allocation. And currently, we're operating at 0.7% of lottery funding, so actually below that threshold of the 1% set back in 1999. And this is just to give you an idea of the rate of growth and the number of people receiving services for gambling treatment compared to the rate of growth of finances that have been invested into these services. Over the past five biennium, there has been about a 35% or so increase in the level of funding toward problem gambling prevention and treatment services. The number of clients coming into our services has increased about 130%. Now I'll describe to you Oregon's problem gambling services, our current system. The first part was just to give you a context of the climate that we're working in. This system went into place. This public health approach was really redesigned and under this new philosophical approach in 2001. And there's Tazio, and this makes him very happy when we talk about problem gambling services. We view problem gambling as very much a public health concern. It's something that affects individuals, it affects families, and it affects communities. These are just a few of the many statistics that I could talk to you about in terms of the way that each of these parameters are affected by gambling. One of the more remarkable aspects that problem gambling has on individuals is the extremely high rate of suicide. In families, some studies have shown that it affects children, that children have twice the incidence rate of broken homes if one of their parents is a problem gambler. There's also links to domestic violence and other problems related to families. Communities are affected.
Dr. Murata?
Yes.
To keep this in perspective, I'd like to compare these stats with alcohol. Mm-hmm. Now, gambling is like 3% of the population. Alcohol is what percentage? Alcoholism is what percentage of the population? Do you know?
Madam Chair, I actually don't know that. Perhaps Dr. Pollack knows.
I think when you include alcoholism and other chemical dependency problems, you're in the range of more like 5 to 7%, I believe.
5 to 7%.
We can confirm that for you, but it is more than, obviously more than problem gambling.
And the only reason I say that, because I know gambling addiction is terrible, but so is alcoholism. And we used to have a prohibition on alcoholism, but I know that will never happen. And when I talk with people regarding gambling in this state, if this went to initiative, I'm afraid that gambling would still be on the list. So I'm just trying to get a perspective here.
To address the prevalence around problem gambling, it's about, from our last study, which was conducted in 2001, it was 0.9% as pathological problem or pathological gambling current, and then 1.6% with subclinical level of problem gambling. So in total, 2.3. Yeah,
okay.
If you look at both of those. So in terms of the relative impact on our broader community, it is less than chemical addictions.
Thank you.
Ways that affects communities, like other addictions, it has really broad ramifications in terms of the impacts that it has. One of the things that we see with problem gamblers, and in fact more and more in the papers, are instances of embezzlement, of crime that's related to a person's gambling addiction. They're also known to be higher utilizers of medical services. So here's some of the systems that the system components that we have currently within Oregon Problem Gambling Services. And these are the ones that are being administered through the Department of Human Services. We have a problem gambling helpline, 877-2-STOP-NOW. It's considered one of the more progressive helplines in the country addressing problem gambling, and has really been a model to many different states. One of the things that makes it unusual is that it's not only being operated by gambling addiction counselors, certified counselors, but they engage the caller when they call in. They go through a process of motivational interviewing, it's called, where they really help the caller come in contact with the consequences of their behaviors. They're on the phone with these people for, I believe, an average of 20 minutes. If they accept a referral, they have three-way calling to a treatment center. If somebody is unavailable at the treatment center, then they will continue to call that caller back with permission in order to make sure that referral went through successfully. The core of our system are our outpatient treatment centers. We have 25 of those throughout the state. We have two residential crisis respite programs, one in Grants Pass and one in St. Helens, and those serve the entire state population. We implemented these later on because we were learning from our treatment centers that we had a number of people coming into treatment that were really unable to engage the recovery process because they were unable to meet their basic needs. They came in, they burned all the bridges, they didn't have any finances. So without any of those resources, they really weren't able to engage treatment. So we set these up as a way to help stabilize individuals.
Dr. Murata, is gambling treatment covered by insurance companies in general?
Generally speaking, it's not. It's under the threshold with the Oregon Health Plan in terms of the cutoff, and most insurance companies do not.
And is this a part, I want to know how this fits in with the parity issue. How do other states, does this fall within mental health parity or not? And examples of other states, have they included that or not?
Mm-hmm. You're bringing up a very good set of questions. Problem gambling or gambling addiction has often been somewhat of an orphan. And what I mean by that, it hasn't been included comprehensively within the addictions field, nor has it been on the mental health side. It's just kind of been out there without a home. It's only recently been recognized as a medical condition. Most states do not cover treatment for problem gambling. Most insurances do not cover treatment for problem gambling. We're somewhat unique. Well, I shouldn't say we're unique. I think about 17 other states that do offer some kinds of services. They're almost all funded the same way that, well, similarly to the way we're funded, in that it's the industry that is subsidizing the costs of gambling treatment services. And in our case, the industry is the state lottery is the main contributor. And just my commentary there is, what one of the things that we know about problem gamblers is they contribute in our case, probably 30% or upwards to the amount of revenue that comes in through our operations. So it seems only justified in my mind anyway that at least a portion of those funds go back to them in the form of help.
Hmm.
Other components of the system, we have a GEAR program.
I want you to repeat that again. You say 30% of our revenues from the lottery are due to those who are addicted to gambling.
From problem gamblers. We from studies done in other jurisdictions that have looked at where the sources of the revenues are coming from, it's very disproportionately coming from individuals who have who were assessed as having a gambling problem. In Australia, it was 58% of the revenues that were being generated through their gambling operations was coming through from problem gamblers. In Canada, it ranges, I believe, from about 20% to 50%. There's from studies done in the U.S. It ranges depending on the type of game. When we look at our lottery's mix of games and where the revenue is generated, most of it is coming in through video poker. And we look at other jurisdictions to determine how much of those proceeds are coming from problem gamblers. That's where I'm getting that estimate from, roughly about 30% of the proceeds coming in are from problem gamblers.
Senator Cruz, or Morissette.
Thank you. Are you separating the tribal gambling from the state gambling? You're not mixing those two into. Did you separate them? The addiction to tribal as opposed to addiction.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we do look. If the question is referring to where are our problem gamblers
coming from? No, I'm sorry. The question refers to, you seem to be talking about the money that's generated that comes into the state of Oregon. You've done the statistics on that amount of money. Mm-hmm. My question is, how much of that have you ever looked at? Some people don't do the state gambling, they go to the casinos. Mm-hmm. So have you done a study on the casino gambling in terms of addiction? Separate it from the state-wide gambling, the state-sanctioned gambling.
Madam Chair, Ms. Senator Morissette, what we know, I could tell you about the revenue that comes in from the different types of gambling. So from the lottery, I believe, draws in about 54% of all gambling expenditures that Oregonians make. In terms of gambling addiction or problem gambling, it looks like the tribes account for about 18%. The Oregon Lottery accounts for about 70%.
Wow. Okay. That's where I wanted to. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. That's interesting. Now, may I follow
up? Yes.
Okay, then I what's interesting, and I want you to think about this answer before you give it, if you do give it. We're going to use the money, the governor wants to use the money to fund the state police. In fact, it was interesting, in the mid-90s, he and Peter Bragdon wrote a very good article that appeared in the New York Times giving all the reasons why you shouldn't use, you know, gambling money for anything. Do you think that the end justifies the means? Hey, we have a shortage of money, and is it justified in your mind to take it from addicted people?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Morse, in the interest of keeping my current position, I may defer that question to the
policy. I told you to be... think. Yeah, okay. You don't have to answer.
When we do look at the cost-benefit analysis, we really just don't have a good science to draw real firm conclusions. I certainly do have an opinion on the matter. But I could also tell you that it's not as cut and dry as one might imagine just looking at the bottom line. I'm being prompted to talk about our balance depression. And one of the things that I've seen conversation with the lottery with and others is how to create a more balanced approach when it comes to state-operated gambling, and that is in part what we're doing currently, putting forth some of those lottery revenues to mitigate the harm that's caused by gambling in the form of treatment and prevention efforts. We're also looking at ways to make these games less addictive. There are some things that we can do that will help protect the consumers. We're looking at ways to better educate the public. So we're very much looking at this from both sides of the issue and trying to develop some form of balance. Really quickly with these other components, these are very good questions that are being raised. The Coffee Creek program, the GEAR program, that this is basically an option where people can receive help for a gambling problem. They don't have to leave their home. They are sent a workbook. They are provided telephone counseling. We brought a version of this program into Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. When inmates there, and it's Oregon's largest female correctional facility, when they are about to be released, within 6 months of the release date, they are screened to determine whether or not they have a history of a gambling problem. And what we found there is about 25% of them are, which is pretty phenomenal when you think about it. And a large number of those women are also reporting that the crimes that led them to incarceration was related to their gambling. But one of the things we want to do is we want to decrease reincarceration rates. We want to keep these people out of prison. We want to help them be successful in making that transition back into their communities. And so we educate them around problem gambling. We provide them tools in order to be successful when they go back into the community. That's a brand new program, so we don't have the full evaluation data back on that.
There's a question.
Thank you, Chair. Is there a disproportionate then number of women who end up incarcerated from gambling addiction versus men going in? Is that what you're saying? Or
let's see, here's the data.
72%.
In terms of the relative occurrence of problem gambling related to crimes between men and women, generally. We don't have that data for Oregon. I could tell you that, but just looking at the literature as a whole, it appears that males have traditionally been at increased risk for developing gambling problems, and the prison studies that I've seen generally had higher rates of problem gambling among the male inmates than it did among the female inmates. It's a problem among both genders, obviously, though. So these are some other components. I'll just kind of move forward. Some of the performance measures that we conduct with in our treatment programs, we look at things like access and retention, successful completion, client satisfaction, long-term outcomes, and treatment penetration. And just to give you an example of how we actually use this, we give report cards to all of the counties that contract with DHS for gambling services. And this is Marion County's actual report card from last year, evaluating them on these different criteria. Seven of those are actually built into the contracts that they're required to meet certain performance criteria, and the other ones are provided for informational and quality improvement purposes. It's the number of enrollments by year, and as you see, it's steadily been going up. We had a large jump in 2001-02, and that's when we implemented this public health approach. And part of that approach was going out and trying to create increased community awareness of the problem. We had several prevention and outreach programs that were implemented that year, and that helped increase the enrollment.
Question. How does that compare then with the numbers of alcohol and addiction? We had 1,500 or, I forget. And how many do we have in alcohol and addiction? What enrollment do we have with those problems?
Madam Chair, I don't know those numbers off the top of my head, but I don't know if Dr. Pollack...
Vastly more.
Yeah,
there's vastly
probably been,
more.
I can get you the exact...
Tenfold more, at least.
Probably at least.
Yeah, okay. I'm just trying to keep it in perspective.
So here's some of the enrollment trends since 1996. One of the things that we found is the proportion of women receiving services went up quite significantly from 37 to 46%. Casino gamblers grew from 10% to 18%. In large part, that's because we've had more casinos come online since 1996. And enrollment increased an average of 40% each biennium. You know, if we do a comparison with the alcohol and drug rates, we won't see that type of growth. But again, in terms of the overall scope of the issue, it's much smaller than with alcohol and drugs. In our client demographics, the majority of the people we see are Caucasian. It's a pretty equal split between men and women. Average age is 44, 41% married. And that number is actually would have been a lot higher. The reason it's as low as it is because their gambling led to divorce prior to them coming into services. 53% worked full-time. The average income was close to $40,000. Average education was 13 years. And this last statistic surprises a lot of people in that 71, so the vast majority of the persons receiving services for problem gambling, did not report any alcohol or drug problems. Not only did they not report it, but during our more formal assessments, it didn't show up either. So what this demonstrates is that problem gambling is really affecting people that were otherwise didn't have a history. This is another information we have. These are run-of-the-mill, average kind of Oregonians that are developing gambling problems. They don't have, in large part, a history of other issues. One of the things that I hear is, well, if it wasn't gambling, it'd be something else. But really, when we look at their history, it doesn't suggest that. Here's some of the consequences of gambling for the people who come into our treatment services. 34% committed illegal acts in order to gamble or to get money to pay off gambling debts. 27% lost a marriage or other significant relationship due to gambling. 23% report suicidal thoughts. 14% report job irresponsibility. And the reason I throw that figure in there is, again, the way it affects our community in terms of lost productivity. And this last number, we just did this statistic this past year. It was quite interesting to find there's a one-to-one ratio of gambling-related debt to annual household income. And what that means is for somebody coming in our programs with an average household income of $100,000, when they came into our programs, they were $100,000 in debt. If they had an average income of $10,000 when they came into our programs, they were $10,000 in debt. And it was quite interesting how closely that pattern followed. System evaluation results. Well, we found that the treatment performance targets were met or exceeded 89% of the time. And that refers back to that report card that I showed you earlier. So our programs are doing very well in meeting the expectations that we established for them. 80% of the clients reported either no gambling or much less gambling at 6 months post-treatment. What we do is we follow the folks after they leave treatment, whether or not they successfully complete treatment or they left before the recommended course of treatment. We evaluate them at 90 days, 6 months, and then for the completers at 12 months. And over 2 million Oregonians were exposed to problem gambling prevention outreach efforts. Many of you have probably seen some of the ads that are out there. And this Oregon is one of the few states that appears to have averted an increase in problem gambling prevalence while expanding legalized gambling. And where this last statement is coming from is kind of dated information at this point. In 1997, we had a prevalence study conducted, and it indicated that 3.3% of the population had a gambling problem. And in 2001, that same study was conducted using the same methodology, and it found there was a 2.3% prevalence. So it actually indicated that it looked like a decrease. However, we know that 2 points don't make a trend, so what we could say is we feel pretty confident that at least in that time period, the prevalence of problem gambling did not increase. And we like to think that one reason it didn't increase was because the state's investments into problem gambling services.
Ma'am.
Senator Murphy.
Yeah, thank you. I do want to go back to my previous discussion item. There's some concern about landing the line games because they will attract people who don't like to play video poker, and that implies it would expand. I don't know if it's just going to take people from another form of gambling or if it will actually expand the base. Now, what I'm struggling with, I guess, I have very mixed feelings about that, about expanding online games. And I don't know what an adequate amount of, what adequate funding is for the problem gamblers. Now, do you have some recommendations, or what's the optimum amount of money we should be putting into the problem gambler program in light of expansion?
Chair, Senator Morissette, thank you for allowing me to address this question in terms of what is adequate, and also what's implied in the question is what kind of impact is line games going to have on Oregon. And one of the great concerns about line games is it's a form of gambling that is very addictive and very popular. You know, it's not more addictive than, say, video poker. However, it's much, much more popular. And so we think there's going to be a lot more people entering the fold of gambling, if you will, and developing problems related to their play. Well, some of the studies found, for instance, that one out of every 28 people who engage in any kind of video lottery terminal play, and this is out of Quebec, will develop a problem related to their play. So it's all these new players coming in. One out of 27 of those individuals may develop a gambling problem if the statistic generalizes to Oregon. The consequences of that are largely unknown. I think we're going to see a jump in our numbers in a year or two. It takes a while for people to actually develop a problem once they engage in the play. It's often starts out as recreational, as responsible, and for a subset of those individuals, they'll progress into a disorder. The adequate funding, if we were to actually receive the full 1%, I think that would be adequate to address the problems. When that legislation was passed, it was based on, I think, a very sound premise, and that is index the amount of funding for problem gambling services to the amount of revenue that is coming in. Because the more revenue is coming in, that means the more losses are accumulating and the larger number of problem gamblers we have out there. So as revenue increases, the number of problem gamblers increase, the need increases. So with the additional line games, what's going to happen is the revenue will, I believe, substantially increase. I wouldn't be surprised if it really exceeded some of the estimates that are currently out there. And if we did have a true 1% contribution to help mitigate the problems created by those new games, mm-hmm. That would probably be adequate in terms of, at the minimum, being able to provide treatment for all those people who request it, and also to engage in a more aggressive outreach and prevention programs.
Okay. Thank you.
So, in conclusion, I feel that problem gambling services work, that the enrollment is growing really at an astonishing rate. The short-term efficacy is very good at 80%, and we don't know what happens with these folks after 6 months, so I have to kind of throw that caveat out there. The prevalence of problem gambling appears in check. We don't have a recent study, but hopefully we'll conduct one of those fairly soon. But much more really does need to be done. Concerns over the recent wave of gambling expansion, and to continue to respond to our changing environment and really to monitor for changes and make the adjustments. And currently, I think we have a system that's well set up to do that, and I feel very positive, actually, about some of the progress that has been made lately to help address the concerns around problem gambling.
Before we go for a discussion, I would like to have a motion to suspend the rules so that Senator Courtney and Senator George can vote on Senate concurrent SCR 1 and Senate Bill 225.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move we suspend the rules to allow Senators Courtney and George to vote on Senate Bill 225 and SCR 1.
Any objection? Oh. Yeah, any objection? So ordered. I'd like to open a work session on SCR 1. Clerk will call the roll. Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Yes.
I'd like to close the work session on SCR 1. And I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 225. Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator George?
Yes.
I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 225.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much.
Now we'll go back to discussion. I find this very, very interesting. When I'm talking to people in my community, from the recreational aspect, this is... especially the elderly, they love to take their RVs, they love, you know, going to the beach or going to Spirit Mountain and gambling, et cetera, but we know there is a growing addiction problem. I was very enlightened to see that our gambling addiction program is working. So I feel that's critical. Anyway, do we have discussion for... Senator George?
Just a quick question. For someone that has been through the treatment and then begins to recidivate, do we encourage them, if you get into trouble again, to come immediately back? So we do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other question is, back in 97, Senator John Lemp, and I served on his committee for 3 years there, we dealt with this issue, and one of the things that I was intrigued by was at that time they said that particularly some of the newer games that we've put in place actually had addictive rhythm. In other words, yeah, I see their head nodding. Is everybody familiar with that concept? Would you go ahead and address that?
He's the expert. I just know what he's talking about.
Senator George, there's a number of features that make these games problematic. One of the ones that has been talked about was the rhythm. Another thing was actually had to do with the pulsation on the screen.
The lights.
Exactly. Yeah, and how that could actually encourage people to enter into a almost like a trance-like state. One of the ways these games are being used improperly is to help people cope. So it's used as a way to cope with other things going on in their life, and because they use it as this kind of coping mechanism, and it allows them to disassociate for them to numb out,
mm-hmm.
much like drugs will do. people will get hooked on it. I could actually go on for quite some time about, there's many different features to a game that are known to cause excessive play, and that excessive play then can contribute to the more problematic and addictive type of behavior.
Madam Chair and Senator George, there is even a recent study that shows neuroimaging effects in problem gamblers that are comparable to those in folks with chemical dependency.
Follow-up question. Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a couple of things that we did back then, and we really stopped the very strong promotion of the gambling, and the ads are completely different now. But there's something, every time I listen to one of those ads, I think, I wonder if the psychological impact of that isn't actually worse, and that is to portray your gambling losses as very good for Oregon. And because, you know, we watch that, don't we? And has anybody measured whether that is? In other words, I'm out here putting myself, you know, $50,000 in debt, but I feel really good about it because I'm helping Oregon. I'm helping the fish and the schools. And
thank you, sir.
These guys know we have another farmer down here. I was asked one time, you know, what is your opinion on gambling? I said, I take everything I own, I put it on a table, and I roll the dice one time a year. My gosh, I've never heard anybody gamble like that. And I said, I'm a farmer.
Yeah.
And that's what we do.
That's what we do.
But have you ever picked up anything like that where a person actually felt very good about becoming addicted because they were helping the state? I mean, I see people nodding their head out here.
Madam Chair, Senator George, often by the time they come into our programs, they're not feeling very good about the
very
state
good.
At all.
But if I could add, Madam Chair and Senator George, that's a characteristic of all kinds of addictions, that the individual who has the self-control problem has ways of rationalizing it
right.
In ways that seem on the surface to be justified, but in the deeper analysis are ignoring the destruction to him or herself and to their family and others in the process of doing so. I would see it as simply another form of rationalization.
It sounds like farming. I have a follow-up question on the serious side. I serve on revenue, and of course we're looking at these numbers that you all think may be bigger than we think they are. But one of the thoughts that I had is we were looking at the trends, and you have the gross amount that's being, you know, churning up here, $9 billion, and then you have the net amount. And the net amount was staying relatively flat. But what was happening is the total growth of the number of dollars that are churning in the system was substantial. And what was also substantial was the amount of payout. And I asked the question in that committee, are we adjusting the payout to make sure that we hook you and hold you? Because if I see I'm losing more, then I may start to retract from participation. But if, in fact, I'm receiving more, the payout is a little bit higher.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are we really hooking somebody with that? Because we're adjusting that number for that reason. That's what we were actually told, that was a relationship between how we've made the payout and the response of the people that were participating.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator George, you're bringing up some really interesting discussion points. These games are designed to make money, and there has been a lot of really smart people working on designing these games to make them optimally productive. And one of those things is determining what is the optimal level of payout. You're absolutely right. If we don't pay out enough, people will get discouraged and leave. If we pay out too much, we just eat into our profit margin. It's actually very complicated, depending on the jurisdiction, you know, whether or not there's competition. Some states where there's just not a lot of competition, the payout for their, say, video slots is quite low.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's in the 80s. Here I believe it's 92%. Now, compared to a casino, you know, their rate's more along the lines of 95-96%. I don't know if that's true for Oregon casinos, but in Vegas where there's lots of competition.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, what's actually more disturbing than that, I think, is the way these games are built these days are on virtual reels. And these games can be designed where it's very legal, however, it's quite deceptive in terms of they're designed so that there's a large number of near misses. So you'll see seven, mm-hmm. seven, oh, just one off the pay line, there's a seven. And it leads the players to believe they're very close to hitting that big one, when in fact, they're not at all.
Odds are the same.
The odds are the same. And so what that does is it encourages persistent play, and it's also, I think, quite deceptive.
Hmm.
So that's just another kind of, that's the game feature, actually, in terms of the way that these things are constructed, that I find is perhaps most troubling.
Any other questions?
Sorry I did that to you.
Oh, this is very interesting. Any other discussion? Thank you very much for coming. You know, we are going to continue this work on parity issues, and we may need to get some more information from you in the future, but this is just a part of the information gathering at this point in time. We still don't have any actual bills in front of us, so thank you so much.
Thank you very much for listening.
Sports. Senator George. I want to compliment these two men. This is some of the most straightforward answers I have ever had. I've been in this building. I appreciate that. So many times we don't get people who tell us everything, and I appreciate your kind of candor.
Thank you.
Committee, Wednesday's meeting is canceled. The bills are coming. Well, on February 16th and February 28th, it looks like we may be having an evening meeting. We are having some out-of-state testimony on some cost containment issues, and this was just how the scheduling works. So I wanted to give you the benefit of...
I need to know more about why we're having an evening meeting.
It's in order to get all of the public testimony in.
For what?
For the cost containments, and I don't have the specific...
Are we talking about the parity bill?
No, it won't be the parity bill. It's, check with me, and I can show you which actual bills we'll be discussing, because we don't have any numbers right now.
Senator, you can do the same for her and have a meeting and have her show up for that.
Yeah, on February 16th, it looks like we'll have the 1 to 3 p.m. And then an evening meeting because of the two experts coming in. And then on February 28th, again, we'll have the 1 to 3 plus an evening, and we have one expert on cost containment. So we couldn't get them both on the same day, but at least we got them two different times.
Cool.
Okay. Any other words for the good of the order? If not, the committee's adjourned.